When the Irish revival began to be appreciable, Mrs. Kearney determined to take advantage of her daughter's name, and brought an Irish teacher to the house. Kathleen and her sister sent Irish picture postcards to their friends, and these friends sent back other Irish picture postcards. On special Sundays, when Mr. Kearney went with his family to the Pro-Cathedral, a little crowd of people would assemble after Mass at the corner of Cathedral Street. They were all friends of the Kearneys, musical friends or nationalist friends, and when they had played every little counter of gossip, they shook hands with one another all together, laughing at the crossing of so many hands, and said goodbye to one another in Irish. Soon the name of Miss Kathleen Kearney began to be heard often on people's lips. People said that she was very clever at music and a very nice girl, and moreover, that she was a believer in the language movement. Mrs. Kearney was well content at this. Therefore, she was not surprised when one day Mr. Holohan came to her and proposed that her daughter should be the accompanist at a series of 4 grand concerts which his society was going to give in the Antient Concert Rooms. She brought him into the drawing room, made him sit down, and brought out the decanter and the silver biscuit barrel. She entered heart and soul into the details of the enterprise, advised and dissuaded, and finally a contract was drawn up, by which Kathleen was to receive 8 guineas for her services as accompanist at the 4 grand concerts. As Mr. Holohan was a novice in such delicate matters as the wording of bills and the disposing of items for a programme, Mrs. Kearney helped him. She had tact. She knew what artistes should go into capitals and what artistes should go into small type. She knew that the first tenor would not like to come on after Mr. Mead's comic turn. To keep the audience continually diverted, she slipped the doubtful items in between the old favourites. Mr. Holohan called to see her every day to have her advice on some point. She was invariably friendly and advising, homely, in fact. She pushed the decanter towards him, saying, "Now help yourself, Mr. Holohan." And while he was helping himself, she said, "Don't be afraid, don't be afraid of it." Everything went on smoothly. Mrs. Kearney brought some lovely blush-pink charmeuse and brown thomases to let into the front of Kathleen's dress. It cost a pretty penny, but there are occasions when a little expense is justifiable. She took a dozen of 2-shilling tickets for the final concert and sent them to those friends who could not be trusted to come otherwise. She forgot nothing, and thanks to her, everything that was to be done was done. The concerts were to be on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. When Mrs. Kearney arrived with her daughter at the Antient Concert Rooms on Wednesday night, she did not like the look of things. A few young men wearing bright blue badges in their coats stood idle in the vestibule. None of them wore evening dress. She passed by with her daughter, and a quick glance through the open door of the hall showed her the cause of the steward's idleness. At first she wondered, had she mistaken the hour? No, it was 8:20. In the dressing room behind the stage, she was introduced to the secretary of the society, Mr. Fitzpatrick. She smiled and shook his hand. He was a little man with a white, vacant face. She noticed that he wore his soft brown hat carelessly on the side of his head, and that his accent was flat. He held a programme in his hand, and while he was talking to her, he chewed one end of it into a moist pulp. He seemed to bear disappointments lightly. Mr. Holohan came into the dressing room every few minutes with reports from the box office. The artistes talked among themselves nervously, glanced from time to time at the mirror, and rolled and unrolled their music. When it was nearly 8:30, the few people in the hall began to express their desire to be entertained. Mr. Fitzpatrick came in, smiled vacantly at the room, and said, "Well now, ladies and gentlemen, I suppose we'd better open the ball." Mrs. Kearney rewarded his very flat final syllable with a quick stare of contempt, and then said to her daughter encouragingly, "Are you ready, dear?" When she had an opportunity, she called Mr. Holohan aside and asked him to tell her what it meant. Mr. Holohan did not know what it meant. He said that the committee had made a mistake in arranging for 4 concerts. 4 was too many. "And the artistes," said Mrs. Kearney. "Of course they are doing their best, but really, they are no good." Mr. Holohan admitted that the artistes were no good, but the committee, he said, had decided to let the first 3 concerts go as they pleased, and reserve all the talent for Saturday night. Mrs. Kearney said nothing, but as the mediocre items followed one another on the platform and the few people in the hall grew fewer and fewer, she began to regret that she had put herself to any expense for such a concert. There was something she didn't like in the look of things, and Mr. Fitzpatrick's vacant smile irritated her very much. However, she said nothing and waited to see how it would end. The concert expired shortly before 10, and everyone went home quickly. The concert on Thursday night was better attended, but Mrs. Kearney saw at once that the house was filled with paper. The audience behaved indecorously, as if the concert were an informal dress rehearsal. Mr. Fitzpatrick seemed to enjoy himself. He was quite unconscious that Mrs. Kearney was taking angry note of his conduct. He stood at the edge of the screen, from time to time jutting out his head and exchanging a laugh with two friends in the corner of the balcony. In the course of the evening, Mrs. Kearney learned that the Friday concert was to be abandoned, and that the committee was going to move heaven and earth to secure a bumper house on Saturday night. When she heard this, she sought out Mr. Holohan. She buttonholed him as he was limping out quickly with a glass of lemonade for a young lady, and asked him, was it true? Yes, it was true. But of course, that doesn't alter the contract, she said. The contract was for four concerts. Mr. Holohan seemed to be in a hurry. He advised her to speak to Mr. Fitzpatrick. Mrs. Kearney was now beginning to be alarmed. She called Mr. Fitzpatrick away from his screen and told him that her daughter had signed for four concerts and that, of course, according to the terms of the contract, she should receive the sum originally stipulated for whether the society gave the four concerts or not. Mr. Fitzpatrick, who did not catch the point at issue very quickly, seemed unable to resolve the difficulty and said that he would bring the matter before the committee. Mrs. Kearney's anger began to flutter in her cheek, and she had all she could do from asking, "And who is the committee, pray?" But she knew that it would not be ladylike to do that, so she was silent. Little boys were sent out into the principal streets of Dublin early on Friday morning with bundles of handbills. Special puffs appeared in all the evening papers, reminding the music-loving public of the treat which was in store for it on the following evening. Mrs. Kearney was somewhat reassured, but she thought well to tell her husband part of her suspicions. He listened carefully and said that perhaps it would be better if he went with her on Saturday night. She agreed. She respected her husband in the same way as she respected the general post office, as something large, secure, and fixed. And though she knew the small number of his talents, she appreciated his abstract value as a male. She was glad that he had suggested coming with her. She thought her plans over. The night of the grand concert came. Mrs. Kearney, with her husband and daughter, arrived at the Antient concert rooms 3/4 of an hour before the time at which the concert was to begin. By ill luck, it was a rainy evening. Mrs. Kearney placed her daughter's clothes and music in charge of her husband and went all over the building looking for Mr. Holohan or Mr. Fitzpatrick. She could find neither. She asked the stewards, was any member of the committee in the hall? And after a great deal of trouble, a steward brought out a little woman named Miss Byrne, to whom Mrs. Kearney explained that she wanted to see one of the secretaries. Miss Byrne expected them any minute and asked, could she do anything? Mrs. Kearney looked searchingly at the oldish face, which was screwed into an expression of trustfulness and enthusiasm, and answered, no, thank you. The little woman hoped they would have a good house. She looked out at the rain until the melancholy of the wet street effaced all the trustfulness and enthusiasm from her twisted features. Then she gave a little sigh and said, oh, well, we did our best, the dear knows. Mrs. Kearney had to go back to the dressing room. The artistes were arriving. The bass and the second tenor had already come. The bass, Mr. Duggan, was a slender young man with a scattered black moustache. He was the son of a hall porter in an office in the city, and as a boy he had sung prolonged bass notes in the resounding hall. From this humble state he had raised himself until he had become a first-rate artiste. He had appeared in grand opera. One night, when an operatic artiste had fallen ill, he had undertaken the part of the king in the opera of Maritana at the Queen's Theatre. He sang his music with great feeling and volume, and was warmly welcomed by the gallery. But unfortunately, He marred the good impression by wiping his nose in his gloved hand once or twice, out of thoughtlessness. He was unassuming and spoke little. He said yous so softly that it passed unnoticed, and he never drank anything stronger than milk for his voice's sake. Mr. Bell, the second tenor, was a fair-haired little man who competed every year for prizes at the Fesh Kill. On his fourth trial, he had been awarded a bronze medal. He was extremely nervous and extremely jealous of other tenors, and he covered his nervous jealousy with an ebullient friendliness. It was his humour to have people know what an ordeal a concert was to him. Therefore, when he saw Mr. Duggan, he went over to him and asked, "Are you in it, too?"
"Yes," said Mr. Duggan.
Mr. Bell laughed at his fellow sufferer, held out his hand, and said, "Shake!" Mrs. Kearney passed by these two young men and went to the edge of the screen to view the house. The seats were being filled up rapidly, and a pleasant noise circulated in the auditorium. She came back and spoke to her husband privately. Their conversation was evidently about Kathleen, for they both glanced at her often, as she stood chatting to one of her nationalist friends, Miss Healy, the contralto. An unknown solitary woman with a pale face walked through the room. The women followed with keen eyes the faded blue dress, which was stretched upon a meagre body. Someone said that she was Madame Glynn, the soprano.
"I wonder where did they dig her up," said Kathleen to Miss Healy. "I'm sure I never heard of her."
Miss Healy had to smile. Mr. Holohan limped into the dressing room at that moment, and the two young ladies asked him who was the unknown woman. Mr. Holohan said that she was Madame Glynn from London. Madame Glynn took her stand in a corner of the room, holding a roll of music stiffly before her and from time to time changing the direction of her startled gaze. The shadow took her faded dress into shelter, but fell revengefully into the little cup behind her collarbone. The noise of the hall became more audible. The first tenor and the baritone arrived together. They were both well-dressed, stout, and complacent, and they brought a breath of opulence among the company. Mrs. Kearney brought her daughter over to them and talked to them amiably. She wanted to be on good terms with them, but while she strove to be polite, her eyes followed Mr. Holohan in his limping and devious courses. As soon as she could, she excused herself and went out after him.
"Mr. Holohan, I want to speak to you for a moment," she said.
They went down to a discreet part of the corridor. Mrs. Kearney asked him when was her daughter going to be paid. Mr. Holohan said that Mr. Fitzpatrick had charge of that. Mrs. Kearney said that she didn't know anything about Mr. Fitzpatrick. Her daughter had signed a contract for 8 guineas, and she would have to be paid. Mr. Holohan said that it wasn't his business.
"Why isn't it your business?" asked Mrs. Kearney.
"Didn't you yourself bring her the contract? Anyway, if it's not your business, it's my business, and I mean to see to it."
"You'd better speak to Mr. Fitzpatrick," said Mr. Holohan distantly.
"I don't know anything about Mr. Fitzpatrick," repeated Mrs. Kearney. "I have my contract, and I intend to see that it is carried out."
When she came back to the dressing room, her cheeks were slightly suffused. The room was lively. Two men in outdoor dress had taken possession of the fireplace and were chatting familiarly with Miss Healy and the baritone. They were the Freeman man and Mr. O'Madden Burke. The Freeman man had come in to say that he could not wait for the concert as he had to report the lecture which an American priest was giving in the Mansion House. He said they were to leave the report for him at the Freeman office, and he would see that it went in. He was a grey-haired man, with a plausible voice and careful manners. He held an extinguished cigar in his hand, and the aroma of cigar smoke floated near him. He had not intended to stay a moment, because concerts and artistes bored him considerably, but he remained leaning against the mantelpiece. Miss Healy stood in front of him talking and laughing. He was old enough to suspect one reason for her politeness, but young enough in spirit to turn the moment to account. The warmth, fragrance, and colour of her body appealed to his senses. He was pleasantly conscious that the bosom which he saw rise and fall slowly beneath him rose and fell at that moment for him, that the laughter and fragrance and wilful glances were his tribute. When he could stay no longer, he took leave of her, regretfully.
"O'Madden Burke will write the notice," he explained to Mr. Holohan, "and I'll see it in."
"Thank you very much, Mr. Hendrick," said Mr. Holohan. "You'll see it in, I know. Now, won't you have a little something before you go?"
"I don't mind," said Mr. Hendrick.
The two men went along some tortuous passages and up a dark staircase and came to a secluded room, where one of the stewards was uncorking bottles for a few gentlemen. One of these gentlemen was Mr. O'Madden Burke, who had found out the room by instinct. He was a suave, elderly man who balanced his imposing body when at rest upon a large silk umbrella. His magniloquent Western name was the moral umbrella upon which he balanced the fine problem of his finances. He was widely respected. While Mr. Holohan was entertaining the Freeman man, Mrs. Kearney was speaking so animatedly to her husband that he had to ask her to lower her voice. The conversation of the others in the dressing room had become strained. Mr. Bell, the first item, stood ready with his music, but the accompanist made no sign. Evidently something was wrong. Mr. Kearney looked straight before him, stroking his beard, while Mrs. Kearney spoke into Kathleen's ear with subdued emphasis. From the hall came sounds of encouragement, clapping and stamping of feet. The first tenor and the baritone and Miss Healy stood together waiting tranquilly, but Mr. Bell's nerves were greatly agitated because he was afraid the audience would think that he had come late. Mr. Holohan and Mr. O'Madden Burke came into the room. In a moment Mr. Holohan perceived the hush. He went over to Mrs. Kearney and spoke with her earnestly. While they were speaking, the noise in the hall grew louder. Mr. Holohan became very red and excited. He spoke volubly, but Mrs. Kearney said curtly at intervals, "She won't go on. She must get her 8 guineas. Mr. Holohan pointed desperately towards the hall where the audience was clapping and stamping. He appealed to Mr. Kearney and to Kathleen. But Mr. Kearney continued to stroke his beard, and Kathleen looked down, moving the point of her new shoe. "It was not her fault," Mrs. Kearney repeated. "She won't go on without her money." After a swift struggle of tongues, Mr. Holohan hobbled out in haste. The room was silent. When the strain of the silence had become somewhat painful, Miss Healy said to the baritone, "Have you seen Mrs. Pat Campbell this week?" The baritone had not seen her, but he had been told that she was very fine. The conversation went no further. The first tenor bent his head and began to count the links of the gold chain, which was extended across his waist, smiling and humming random notes to observe the effect on the frontal sinus. From time to time, everyone glanced at Mrs. Kearney. The noise in the auditorium had risen to a clamour when Mr. Fitzpatrick burst into the room, followed by Mr. Holohan, who was panting. The clapping and stamping in the hall were punctuated by whistling. Mr. Fitzpatrick held a few banknotes in his hand. He counted out 4 into Mrs. Kearney's hand and said she would get the other half at the interval. Mrs. Kearney said, "This is 4 shillings short." But Kathleen gathered in her skirt and said, "Now, Mr. Bell," to the first item, who was shaking like an aspen. The singer and the accompanist went out together. The noise in the hall died away. There was a pause of a few seconds, and then the piano was heard. The first part of the concert was very successful, except for Madame Glynn's item. The poor lady sang Killarney in a bodiless, gasping voice, with all the old-fashioned mannerisms of intonation and pronunciation, which she believed lent elegance to her singing. She looked as if she had been resurrected from an old stage wardrobe, and the cheaper parts of the hall made fun of her high, wailing notes. The first tenor and the contralto, however, brought down the house. Kathleen played a selection of Irish airs, which was generously applauded. The first part closed with a stirring patriotic recitation delivered by a young lady who arranged amateur theatricals. It was deservedly applauded, and when it was ended, the men went out for the interval, content. All this time, the dressing room was a hive of excitement. In one corner were Mr. Holohan, Mr. Fitzpatrick, Miss Byrne, 2 of the stewards, the baritone, the bass, and Mr. O'Madden Burke. Mr. O'Madden Burke said it was the most scandalous exhibition he had ever witnessed. "Miss Kathleen Kearney's musical career was ended in Dublin after that," he said. The baritone was asked what did he think of Mrs. Kearney's conduct. He did not like to say anything. He had been paid his money, and wished to be at peace with men. However, he said that Mrs. Kearney might have taken the artistes into consideration. The stewards and the secretaries debated hotly as to what should be done when the interval came. I agree with Miss Byrne, said Mr. O'Madden Burke. Pay her nothing. In another corner of the room were Mrs. Kearney and her husband, Mr. Bell, Miss Healy, and the young lady who had recited the patriotic piece. Mrs. Kearney said that the committee had treated her scandalously. She had spared neither trouble nor expense, and this was how she was repaid. They thought they had only a girl to deal with, and that therefore they could ride roughshod over her, but she would show them their mistake. They wouldn't have dared to have treated her like that if she had been a man. But she would see that her daughter got her rights. She wouldn't be fooled. If they didn't pay her to the last farthing, she would make Dublin ring. Of course she was sorry for the sake of the artistes, but what else could she do? She appealed to the second tenor, who said he thought she had not been well treated. Then she appealed to Miss Healy. Miss Healy wanted to join the other group, but she did not like to do so because she was a great friend of Kathleen's, and the Kearneys had often invited her to their house. As soon as the first part was ended, Mr. Fitzpatrick and Mr. Holohan went over to Mrs. Kearney and told her that the other 4 guineas would be paid after the committee meeting on the following Tuesday, and that in case her daughter did not play for the second part, the committee would consider the contract broken and would pay nothing.
"I haven't seen any committee," said Mrs. Kearney angrily. "My daughter has her contract. She will get £4.08 into her hand, or a foot she won't put on that platform."
"I'm surprised at you, Mrs. Kearney," said Mr. Holohan. "I never thought you would treat us this way."
"And what way did you treat me?"
asked Mrs. Kearney. Her face was inundated with an angry colour, and she looked as if she would attack someone with her hands.
"I'm asking for my rights," she said.
"You might have some sense of decency," said Mr. Holohan.
"Might I, indeed? And when I ask when my daughter is going to be paid, I can't get a civil answer."
She tossed her head and assumed a haughty voice.
"You must speak to the secretary. It's not my business. I'm a great fellow, follow the diddle I do."
"I thought you were a lady," said Mr. Holohan, walking away from her abruptly. After that, Mrs. Kearney's conduct was condemned on all hands. Everyone approved of what the committee had done. She stood at the door, haggard with rage, arguing with her husband and daughter, gesticulating with them. She waited until it was time for the second part to begin in the hope that the secretaries would approach her, but Miss Healy had kindly consented to play 1 or 2 accompaniments. Mrs. Kearney had to stand aside to allow the baritone and his accompanist to pass up to the platform. She stood still for an instant like an angry stone image, and when the first notes of the song struck her ear, she caught up her daughter's cloak and said to her husband, "Get a cab." He went out at once. Mrs. Kearney wrapped the cloak round her daughter and followed him. As she passed through the doorway, she stopped and glared into Mr. Holohan's face.
"I'm not done with you yet," she said.
"But I'm done with you," said Mr. Holohan.
Kathleen followed her mother meekly. Mr. Holohan began to pace up and down the room in order to cool himself, for he felt his skin on fire.
"That's a nice lady," he said. "Oh, she's a nice lady."
"You did the proper thing, Holohan," said Mr. O'Madden Burke, poised upon his umbrella in approval.
Grace. 2 gentlemen who were in the lavatory at the time tried to lift him up, but he was quite helpless. He lay curled up at the foot of the stairs down which he had fallen. They succeeded in turning him over. His hat had rolled a few yards away, and his clothes were smeared with the filth and ooze of the floor on which he had lain, face downwards. His eyes were closed, and he breathed with a grunting noise. A thin stream of blood trickled from the corner of his mouth. These 2 gentlemen and 1 of the curates carried him up the stairs and laid him down again on the floor of the bar. In 2 minutes, he was surrounded by a ring of men. The manager of the bar asked everyone who he was and who was with him. No one knew who he was, but 1 of the curates said he had served the gentleman with a small rum.
"Was he by himself?" asked the manager.
"No, sir, there was 2 gentlemen with him. And where are they?" "No one knew," a voice said. "Give him air, he's fainted." The ring of onlookers distended and closed again elastically. A dark medal of blood had formed itself near the man's head on the tessellated floor. The manager, alarmed by the grey pallor of the man's face, sent for a policeman. His collar was unfastened and his necktie undone. He opened his eyes for an instant, sighed, and closed them again. One of the gentlemen who had carried him upstairs held a dinged silk hat in his hand. The manager asked repeatedly did no one know who the injured man was or where had his friends gone. The door of the bar opened and an immense constable entered. A crowd, which had followed him down the laneway, collected outside the door, struggling to look in through the glass panels. The manager at once began to narrate what he knew. The constable, a young man with thick, immobile features, listened. He moved his head slowly to right and left, and from the manager to the person on the floor, as if he feared to be the victim of some delusion. Then he drew off his glove, produced a small book from his waist, licked the lead of his pencil, and made ready to indict. He asked in a suspicious provincial accent, "Who is the man? What's his name and address?" A young man in a cycling suit cleared his way through the ring of bystanders. He knelt down promptly beside the injured man and called for water. The constable knelt down also to help. The young man washed the blood from the injured man's mouth and then called for some brandy. The constable repeated the order in an authoritative voice until a curate came running with the glass. The brandy was forced down the man's throat. In a few seconds he opened his eyes and looked about him. He looked at the circle of faces, and then, understanding, strove to rise to his feet. "You're all right now?" asked the young man in the cycling suit. "Shas, nothing," said the injured man, trying to stand up. He was helped to his feet. The manager said something about a hospital, and some of the bystanders gave advice. The battered silk hat was placed on the man's head. The constable asked, "Where do you live?" The man, without answering, began to twirl the ends of his moustache. He made light of his accident. "It was nothing," he said, "only a little accident." He spoke very thickly. "Where do you live?" repeated the constable. The man said they were to get a cab for him. While the point was being debated, a tall, agile gentleman of fair complexion, wearing a long yellow ulster, came from the far end of the bar. Seeing the spectacle, he called out,
"Hello, Tom, old man, what's the trouble?" "Just nothing," said the man.
The newcomer surveyed the deplorable figure before him and then turned to the constable, saying,
"It's all right, constable, I'll see him home."
The constable touched his helmet and answered, "All right, Mr. Power."
"Come now, Tom,"
said Mr. Power, taking his friend by the arm.
"No bones broken. What, can you walk?"
The young man in the cycling suit took the man by the other arm, and the crowd divided.
"How did you get yourself into this mess?" asked Mr. Power.
"The gentleman fell down the stairs," said the young man.
"I very much obliged to you, sir," said the injured man.
"Not at all.
And we have a little..."
"Not now, not now." The three men left the bar, and the crowd sifted through the doors into the laneway. The manager brought the constable to the stairs to inspect the scene of the accident. They agreed that the gentleman must have missed his footing. The customers returned to the counter, and a curate set about removing the traces of blood from the floor. When they came out into Grafton Street, Mr. Power whistled for an outsider. The injured man said again, as well as he could,
"I'm very much obliged to you, sir. I hope we'll eat again. Is Kernan."
The shock and the incipient pain had partly sobered him. "Don't mention it," said the young man. They shook hands. Mr. Kernan was hoisted onto the car, and while Mr. Power was giving directions to the carman, he expressed his gratitude to the young man and regretted that they could not have a little drink together. "Another time," said the young man. The car drove off towards Westmoreland Street. As it passed the ballast office, the clock showed 9:30. A keen east wind hit them, blowing from the mouth of the river. Mr. Kernan was huddled together with cold. His friend asked him to tell how the accident had happened.
He answered, "I only's hurt.
Show?" The other leaned over the well of the car and peered into Mr. Kernan's mouth, but he could not see. He struck a match, and sheltering it in the shell of his hands, peered again into the mouth, which Mr. Kernan opened obediently. The swaying movement of the car brought the match to and from the opened mouth. The lower teeth and gums were covered with clotted blood, and a minute piece of the tongue seemed to have been bitten off. The match was blown out. "That's ugly," said Mr. Power.
"That's nothing,"
said Mr. Kernan, closing his mouth and pulling the collar of his filthy coat across his neck. Mr. Kernan was a commercial traveller of the old school, which believed in the dignity of its calling. He had never been seen in the city without a silk hat of some decency and a pair of gaiters. By grace of these two articles of clothing, he said, a man could always pass muster. He carried on the tradition of his Napoleon, the great black white, whose memory he evoked at times by legend and mimicry. Modern business methods had spared him only so far as to allow him a little office in Crow Street, on the window blind of which was written the name of his firm, with the address, London EC. On the mantelpiece of this little office, a little leaden battalion of canisters was drawn up, and on the table before the window stood four or five china bowls, which were usually half full of a black liquid. From these bowls Mr. Kernan tasted tea. He took a mouthful, drew it up, saturated his palate with it, and then spat it forth into the grate. Then he paused to judge. Mr. Power, a much younger man, was employed in the Royal Irish Constabulary Office in Dublin Castle. The arc of his social rise intersected the arc of his friend's decline, but Mr. Kernan's decline was mitigated by the fact that certain of those friends who had known him at his highest point of success still esteemed him as a character. Mr. Power was one of these friends. His inexplicable deaths were a byword in his circle. He was a debonair young man. The car halted before a small house on the Glasnevin Road, and Mr. Kernan was helped into the house. His wife put him to bed while Mr. Power sat downstairs in the kitchen asking the children where they went to school and what book they were in. The children, two girls and a boy, conscious of their father's helplessness and of their mother's absence, began some horseplay with him. He was surprised at their manners and at their accents, and his brow grew thoughtful. After a while, Mrs. Kernan entered the kitchen, exclaiming,
"Such a sight! Oh, he'll do for himself one day, and that's the holy odds of it. He's been drinking since Friday."
Mr. Power was careful to explain to her that he was not responsible, that he had come on the scene by the merest accident. Mrs. Kernan, remembering Mr. Power's good offices during domestic quarrels, as well as many small but opportune loans, said,
"Oh, you needn't tell me that, Mr. Power. I know you're a friend of his, not like some of those others he does be with. They're all right so long as he has money in his pocket to keep him out from his wife and family. Nice friends. Who was he with tonight, I'd like to know?"
Mr. Power shook his head, but said nothing.
"I'm so sorry," she continued, "that I've nothing in the house to offer you, but if you wait a minute I'll send round to Fogarty's at the corner."
Mr. Power stood up.
"We were waiting for him to come home with the money. He never seems to think he has a home at all."
"Oh, no, Mrs. Kernan," said Mr. Power. "We'll make him turn over a new leaf. I'll talk to Martin. He's the man. We'll come here one of these nights and talk it over."
She saw him to the door. The carman was stamping up and down the footpath and swinging his arms to warm himself.
"It's very kind of you to bring him home," she said.
"Not at all," said Mr. Power. He got up in the car. As it drove off, he raised his hat to her gaily.
"We'll make a new man of him," he said. "Good night, Mrs. Kernan."
Mrs. Kernan's puzzled eyes watched the car till it was out of sight. Then she withdrew them, went into the house, and emptied her husband's pockets. She was an active, practical woman of middle age. Not long before, she had celebrated her silver wedding and renewed her intimacy with her husband by waltzing with him to Mr. Power's accompaniment. In her days of courtship, Mr. Kernan had seemed to her a not ungallant figure, and she still hurried to the chapel door whenever a wedding was reported, and seeing the bridal pair, recalled with vivid pleasure how she had passed out of the Star of the Sea Church in Sandymount, leaning on the arm of a jovial, well-fed man who was dressed smartly in a frock coat and lavender trousers and carried a silk hat gracefully balanced upon his other arm. After 3 weeks she had found a wife's life irksome, and later on, when she was beginning to find it unbearable, she had become a mother. The part of mother presented to her no insuperable difficulties, and for 25 years she had kept house shrewdly for her husband. Her two eldest sons were launched,
One was in a draper's shop in Glasgow, and the other was clerk to a tea merchant in Belfast. They were good sons, wrote regularly, and sometimes sent home money. The other children were still at school. Mr. Kernan sent a letter to his office next day and remained in bed. She made beef tea for him and scolded him roundly. She accepted his frequent intemperance as part of the climate, healed him dutifully whenever he was sick, and always tried to make him eat a breakfast. There were worse husbands. He had never been violent since the boys had grown up, and she knew that he would walk to the end of Thomas Street and back again to book even a small order. 2 nights after his friends came to see him, she brought them up to his bedroom, the air of which was impregnated with a personal odour, and gave them chairs at the fire. Mr. Kernan's tongue, the occasional stinging pain of which made him somewhat irritable during the day, became more polite. He sat propped up in the bed by pillows, and the little colour in his puffy cheeks made them resemble warm cinders. He apologised to his guests for the disorder of the room, but at the same time looked at them a little proudly, with a veteran's pride. He was quite unconscious that he was the victim of a plot, which his friends, Mr. Cunningham, Mr. McCoy, and Mr. Power, had disclosed to Mrs. Kernan in the parlour. The idea had been Mr. Power's, but its development was entrusted to Mr. Cunningham. Mr. Kernan came of Protestant stock, and though he had been converted to the Catholic faith at the time of his marriage, he had not been in the pale of the church for 20 years. He was fond, moreover, of giving side thrusts at Catholicism. Mr. Cunningham was the very man for such a case. He was an elder colleague of Mr. Power. His own domestic life was not very happy. People had great sympathy with him, for it was known that he had married an unpresentable woman who was an incurable drunkard. He had set up house for her 6 times, and each time she had pawned the furniture on him. Everyone had respect for poor Martin Cunningham. He was a thoroughly sensible man, influential and intelligent. His blade of human knowledge, natural astuteness, particularised by long association with cases in the police courts, had been tempered by brief immersions in the waters of general philosophy. He was well informed. His friends bowed to his opinions and considered that his face was like Shakespeare's. When the plot had been disclosed to her, Mrs. Kernan had said, "I leave it all in your hands, Mr. Cunningham." After a quarter of a century of married life, she had very few illusions left. Religion for her was a habit, and she suspected that a man of her husband's age would not change greatly before death. She was tempted to see a curious appropriateness in his accident, and but that she did not wish to seem bloody-minded, she would have told the gentleman that Mr. Kernan's tongue would not suffer by being shortened. However, Mr. Cunningham was a capable man, and religion was religion. The scheme might do good, and at least it could do no harm. Her beliefs were not extravagant. She believed steadily in the Sacred Heart as the most generally useful of all Catholic devotions, and approved of the sacraments. Her faith was bounded by her kitchen, but if she was put to it, she could believe also in the Banshee and in the Holy Ghost. The gentleman began to talk of the accident. Mr. Cunningham said that he had once known a similar case. A man of 70 had bitten off a piece of his tongue during an epileptic fit, and the tongue had filled in again so that no one could see a trace of the bite. "Well, I'm not 70," said the invalid. "God forbid," said Mr. Cunningham. "It doesn't pain you now?" asked Mr. McCoy. Mr. McCoy had been at one time a tenor of some reputation. His wife, who had been a soprano, still taught young children to play the piano at low terms. His line of life had not been the shortest distance between 2 points, and for short periods he had been driven to live by his wits. He had been a clerk in the Midland Railway, a canvasser for advertisements for the Irish Times and for the Freeman's Journal, a town traveller for a coal firm on commission, a private inquiry agent, a clerk in the office of the sub-sheriff, and he had recently become secretary to the city coroner. His new office made him professionally interested in Mr. Kernan's case. "Pain? Not much," answered Mr. Kernan. "But it's so sickening, I feel as if I wanted to retch off." "That's the booze," said Mr. Cunningham firmly. "No," said Mr. Kernan. "I think I caught a cold in the car. There's something keeps coming into my throat, phlegm or
mucus, said Mr. McCoy. It keeps coming, like, from down in my throat, sickening thing.
Yes, yes, said Mr. McCoy. That's the thorax. He looked at Mr. Cunningham and Mr. Power at the same time with an air of challenge. Mr. Cunningham nodded his head rapidly, and Mr. Power said,
Oh, well, all's well that ends well. I'm very much obliged to you, old man, said the invalid.
Mr. Power waved his hand.
Those other two fellows I was with, who were you with?
Asked Mr. Cunningham.
A chap, I don't know his name. Damn it now, what's his name? Little chap with sandy hair. And who else? Harford?
Said Mr. Cunningham. When Mr. Cunningham made that remark, people were silent. It was known that the speaker had secret sources of information. In this case, the monosyllable had a moral intention. Mr. Harford sometimes formed one of a little detachment, which left the city shortly after noon on Sunday, with the purpose of arriving as soon as possible at some public house on the outskirts of the city, where its members duly qualified themselves as bona fide travellers. But his fellow travellers had never consented to overlook his origin. He had begun life as an obscure financier by lending small sums of money to workmen at usurious interest. Later on, he had become the partner of a very fat, short gentleman, Mr. Goldberg, of the Liffey Loan Bank. Though he had never embraced more than the Jewish ethical code, his fellow Catholics, whenever they had smarted in person or by proxy under his exactions, spoke of him bitterly as an Irish Jew and an illiterate, and saw divine disapproval of usury made manifest through the person of his idiot son. At other times, they remembered his good points.
"I wonder where did he go to?" said Mr. Kernan.
He wished the details of the incident to remain vague. He wished his friends to think there had been some mistake, that Mr. Harford and he had missed each other. His friends, who knew quite well Mr. Harford's manners in drinking, were silent. Mr. Power said again,
All's well that ends well.
Mr. Kernan changed the subject at once.
That was a decent young chap, that medical fellow, he said. Only for him. Oh, only for him, said Mr. Power. It might have been a case of 7 days without the option of a fine.
Yes, yes, said Mr. Kernan, trying to remember. I remember now there was a policeman. Decent young fellow, he seemed.
How did it happen at all?
It happened that you were polluted, Tom, said Mr. Cunningham, gravely.
True, Bill, said Mr. Kernan, equally gravely.
I suppose you squared the constable, Jack, said Mr. McCoy.
Mr. Power did not relish the use of his Christian name. He was not straight-laced, but he could not forget that Mr. McCoy had recently made a crusade in search of valises and portmanteaus, to enable Mrs. McCoy to fulfil imaginary engagements in the country. More than he resented the fact that he had been victimised, he resented such low playing of the game. He answered the question, therefore, as if Mr. Kernan had asked it. The narrative made Mr. Kernan indignant. He was keenly conscious of his citizenship, wished to live with his city on terms mutually honourable, and resented any affront put upon him by those whom he called country bumpkins.
Is this what we pay rates for? He asked. To feed and clothe these ignorant bostoons, and are nothing else.
Mr. Cunningham laughed. He was a castle official only during office hours.
How could they be anything else, Tom? He said.
He assumed a thick provincial accent and said in a tone of command,
65, catch your cabbage!
Everyone laughed. Mr. McCoy, who wanted to enter the conversation by any door, pretended that he had never heard the story. Mr. Cunningham said,
It is supposed, they say, you know, to take place in the depot where they get these thundering big country fellas, omadons, you know, to drill. The sergeant makes them stand in a row against the wall and held up their plates.
He illustrated the story by grotesque gestures.
At dinner, you know. Then he has a bloody big bowl of cabbage before him on the table and a bloody big spoon like a shovel. He takes up a wad of cabbage on the spoon and pegs it across the room and the poor devils have to try and catch it on their plates. 65, catch your cabbage!
Everyone laughed again.
but Mr. Kernan was somewhat indignant still. He talked of writing a letter to the papers.
"These yahoos coming up here," he said, "think they can boss the people. I needn't tell you, Martin, what kind of men they are."
Mr. Cunningham gave a qualified assent.
"It's like everything else in this world," he said. "You get some bad ones, and you get some good ones."
"Oh, yes, you get some good ones, I admit," said Mr. Kernan, satisfied.
"It's better to have nothing to say to them," said Mr. McCoy. "That's my opinion."
Mrs. Kernan entered the room, and placing a tray on the table, said, "Help yourselves, gentlemen." Mr. Power stood up to officiate, offering her his chair. She declined it, saying she was ironing downstairs, and after having exchanged a nod with Mr. Cunningham behind Mr. Power's back, prepared to leave the room. Her husband called out to her,
"And have you nothing for me, Ducky?"
"Oh, you, the back of my hand to you," said Mrs. Kernan tartly.
Her husband called after her,
"Nothing for poor little hubby."
He assumed such a comical face and voice that the distribution of the bottles of stout took place amid general merriment. The gentlemen drank from their glasses, set the glasses again on the table, and paused. Then Mr. Cunningham turned towards Mr. Power and said casually,
"On Thursday night," he said, "Jack."
"Thursday, yes," said Mr. Power.
"Righto,"
said Mr. Cunningham promptly.
"We can meet in Morley's," said Mr. McCoy. "That'll be the most convenient place."
"But we mustn't be late," said Mr. Power earnestly, "because it is sure to be crammed to the doors."
"We can meet at 7:30, said Mr. McCoy.
"Righto,"
said Mr. Cunningham.
7:30 at Morley's be it."
There was a short silence. Mr. Kernan waited to see whether he would be taken into his friend's confidence. Then he asked,
"What's in the wind?"
"Oh, it's nothing," said Mr. Cunningham. "It's only a little matter that we're arranging about for Thursday."
"The opera, is it?"
said Mr. Kernan.
"No, no,"
said Mr. Cunningham in an evasive tone.
"It's just a little spiritual matter."
"Oh,"
said Mr. Kernan. There was silence again. Then Mr. Power said point blank,
"To tell you the truth, Tom, we're going to make a retreat."
"Yes, that's it," said Mr. Cunningham. "Jack and I and McCoy here, we're all going to wash the pot." He uttered the metaphor with a certain homely energy and, encouraged by his own voice, proceeded,
"You see, we may as well all admit we're a nice collection of scoundrels, one and all. I say one and all," he added with gruff charity and turning to Mr. Power. "Own up now."
"I own up," said Mr. Power.
"And I own up," said Mr. McCoy.
"So we're going to wash the pot together," said Mr. Cunningham.
A thought seemed to strike him. He turned suddenly to the invalid and said,
"Do you know what, Tom, has just occurred to me? You might join in and we'd have a four-handed reel."
"Good idea," said Mr. Power. "The four of us together."
Mr. Kernan was silent. The proposal conveyed very little meaning to his mind, but understanding that some spiritual agencies were about to concern themselves on his behalf, he thought he owed it to his dignity to show a stiff neck. He took no part in the conversation for a long while, but listened with an air of calm enmity while his friends discussed the Jesuits.
"I haven't such a bad opinion of the Jesuits," he said, intervening at length. "They're an educated order. I believe they mean well, too."
"They're the grandest order in the church, Tom," said Mr. Cunningham, with enthusiasm. "The general of the Jesuits stands next to the Pope."
"There's no mistake about it," said Mr. McCoy. "If you want the thing well done and no flies about it, you go to a Jesuit. They're the boyos of influence. I'll tell you a case in point. The Jesuits are a fine body of men," said Mr. Power.
"It's a curious thing," said Mr. Cunningham, "about the Jesuit order. Every other order of the church had to be reformed at some time or other, but the Jesuit order was never once reformed. It never fell away."
"Is that so?"
asked Mr. McCoy.
"That's a fact," said Mr. Cunningham. "That's history. Look at their church, too," said Mr. Power. "Look at the congregation they have." "The Jesuits cater for the upper classes," said Mr. McCoy.
"Of course," said Mr. Power.
"Yes," said Mr. Kernan. "That's why I have a feeling for them. It's some of these secular priests, ignorant, bumptious. They're all good men," said Mr. Cunningham, "each in his own way. The Irish priesthood
is honored all the world over. Oh, yes, said Mr. Power. Not like some of the other priesthoods on the continent, said Mr. McCoy. Unworthy of the name.
Perhaps you're right, said Mr. Kernan, relenting.
Of course I'm right, said Mr. Cunningham. I haven't been in the world all this time and seen most sides of it without being a judge of character.
The gentlemen drank again, one following another's example. Mr. Kernan seemed to be weighing something in his mind. He was impressed. He had a high opinion of Mr. Cunningham as a judge of character and as a reader of faces. He asked for particulars.
Oh, it's just a retreat, you know, said Mr. Cunningham. Father Purden has given it. It's for businessmen, you know.
He won't be too hard on us, Tom, said Mr. Power persuasively.
Father Purden? Father Purden, said the invalid.
Oh, you must know him, Tom, said Mr. Cunningham, stoutly. Fine, jolly fellow. He's a man of the world like ourselves.
Yes, I think I know him. Rather red face, tall. That's the man. And tell me, Martin, is he a good preacher?
No, it's not exactly a sermon, you know. It's just a kind of friendly talk, you know, in a common sense way.
Mr. Kernan deliberated. Mr. McCoy said, Father Tom Burke. That was the boy. Oh, Father Tom Burke, said Mr. Cunningham. That was a born orator. Did you ever hear him, Tom?
Did I ever hear him? Said the invalid, nettled.
Rather, I heard him. And yet they say he wasn't much of a theologian, said Mr. Cunningham.
Is that so? Said Mr. McCoy.
Oh, of course, nothing wrong, you know. Only sometimes they say he didn't preach what was quite orthodox.
Ah, he was a splendid man, said Mr. McCoy.
I heard him once, Mr. Kernan continued. I forget the subject of his discourse now. Crofton and I were in the back of the pit, you know, the body, said Mr. Cunningham.
Yes, in the back, near the door.
I forget now what...
Oh, yes, it was on the Pope, the late Pope. I remember it well. Upon my word, it was magnificent. The style of the oratory and his voice. God, hadn't he a voice, the prisoner... Of the Vatican, he called him. I remember Crofton saying to me when we came out,
But he's an Orangeman, Crofton, isn't he? Said Mr. Power.
Of course he is, said Mr. Kernan.
And a damned decent Orangeman, too. We went into Butler's in Moore Street.
Faith, I was genuinely moved, to tell you the God's truth, and I remember well his very words.
Kernan, he said, we worship at different altars, he said, but our belief is the same.
Struck me as very well put.
There's a good deal in that, said Mr. Power. There used to always be crowds of Protestants in the chapel when Father Tom was preaching.
There's not much difference between us, said Mr. McCoy. We both believe in...
He hesitated for a moment.
In the Redeemer. Only they don't believe in the Pope and in the Mother of God.
But of course, said Mr. Cunningham quietly and effectively, our religion... is the religion, the original faith.
Not a doubt of it, said Mr. Kernan warmly.
Mrs. Kernan came to the door of the bedroom and announced,
Here's a visitor for you.
Who is it?
Mr. Fogarty.
Oh, come in, come in.
A pale oval face came forward into the light. The arch of its fair trailing moustache was repeated in the fair eyebrows looped above pleasantly astonished eyes. Mr. Fogarty was a modest grocer. He had failed in business in a licensed house in the city because his financial condition had constrained him to tie himself to a second-class distillers and brewers. He had opened a small shop on Glasnevin Road, where he flattered himself his manners would ingratiate him with the housewives of the district. He bore himself with a certain grace, complimented little children, and spoke with a neat enunciation. He was not without culture. Mr. Fogarty brought a gift with him, a half pint of special whisky. He inquired politely for Mr. Kernan, placed his gift on the table, and sat down with the company on equal terms. Mr. Kernan appreciated the gift all the more since he was aware that there was a small account for groceries unsettled between him and Mr. Fogarty. He said,
I wouldn't doubt you, old man. Open that, Jack, will you?
Mr. Power again officiated. Glasses were rinsed, and five small measures of whisky were poured out. This new influence enlivened the conversation. Mr. Fogarty, sitting on a small area of the chair, was specially interested.
Pope Leo the 13th, said Mr. Cunningham, was one of the lights of the age. His great idea, you know, was the union of the Latin and Greek churches. That was the aim of his life.
I often heard he was one of the most intellectual men in Europe, said Mr. Power. I mean, apart from his being Pope.
So he was, said Mr. Cunningham, if not the most so. His motto, you know, as Pope, was lux upon lux, light upon light.
No, no, said Mr. Fogarty eagerly. I think you're wrong there. It was lux in tenebris, I think, light in darkness.
Oh, yes, said Mr. McCoy, tenebrae.
Allow me, said Mr. Cunningham positively. It was lux upon lux, and Pius the Ninth.
His predecessor's motto was crux upon crux, that is, cross upon cross, to show the difference between their two pontificates. The inference was allowed.
Mr. Cunningham continued.
Pope Leo, you know, was a great scholar and a poet. He had a strong face, said Mr. Kernan.
Yes, said Mr. Cunningham. He wrote Latin poetry.
Is that so? Said Mr. Fogarty.
Mr. McCoy tasted his whisky contentedly and shook his head with a double intention, saying,
that's no joke, I can tell you.
We didn't learn that, Tom, said Mr. Power, following Mr. McCoy's example, when we went to the penny-a-week school.
There was many a good man went to the penny-a-week school with a sod of turf under his oxter, said Mr. Kernan sententiously. The old system was the best, plain, honest education. None of your modern trumpery.
Quite right, said Mr. Power.
No superfluities, said Mr. Fogarty.
He enunciated the word and then drank gravely.
I remember reading, said Mr. Cunningham, that one of Pope Leo's poems was on the invention of the photograph.
In Latin, of course.
On the photograph, exclaimed Mr. Kernan.
Yes, said Mr. Cunningham. He also drank from his glass.
Well, you know,